Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is our producer, Lee Cantor, and my good buddy and co-host, Todd Schnick. Good morning, Todd.
Warren Stone, how are you this morning?
I am doing well. What's happening with you, man?
Oh, gosh. This was actually a very quiet weekend. It was, as you know, previous week I was in Nashville running that half marathon. So this weekend was a catch-up.
Would you
reacquaint myself with Mrs. Schnick?
And beer and ribs and all that. Did you get off the marathon diet?
No. I'm training for the next one, pal. None of this beer and ribs stuff.
When's the next one coming? It's
Labor Day.
Labor Day. All right. And are you raising money for anybody on that one?
No. This is to keep Todd's heart strong and true.
And are you traveling to some exotic destination?
This one will be in Virginia Beach.
Virginia Beach. Fun stuff.
And flat, thank God.
Well, I got a new ride over the weekend.
Yeah, tell me about your trip.
Well, you know, my retired father has a lot more time and money on his hands than he knows what to do with. So he called me during the middle of the week, asked me if I needed a car. And I said, well, you know, I'll certainly take one. He found one. It's a... compared to the van that you call the Tylenol, it's nice, man. It's got 109,000 miles on it. It's almost brand new.
Brand new, 109,000 miles.
That's right. Pontiac Bonneville, four-door. It's
one of those former cop cars, isn't it?
Yeah, and on the way home today, I didn't think about it. It's exactly what it looks like.
Does it have, like, the big, thick cop tires? And
you know, it's got Michelins, 109,000-mile car. It's got brand new Michelins on it, but I'm going to stop by on the way home and get some curb feelers. You know, those fancy hubcaps that go two or three different ways.
It's a former cop car. I just know it. It's white, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's white.
I knew it.
All my cars are white.
Be like Jake and Elwood and the Blues Brothers.
That's it.
Got it.
We need to get like a High Velocity Radio banner for the Video Dust Jacket Tour.
Oh, okay.
When we go on tour this summer, because we got to get a couple more cities under our belt for the Video Dust Jacket Tour, we'll get the decal, we'll NASCAR that baby out.
We'll be on a mission from God.
Yeah, I like it. We already got the sunglasses.
We got those.
We're set.
Right.
Well, we've got a great show this morning. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from a gentleman by the name of Jeff Lindsay, who is not out of Atlanta. He's out of Appleton, Wisconsin. He's down
God's
here
country.
For a conference. He's written a very interesting book on innovation fatigue. But first up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning is a gentleman by the name of Jack Bergstrand. He is the CEO and founder of Brand Velocity, and he's the author of a book called Reinvent Your Enterprise. Welcome to the show, Jack.
It's great to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit about this book and what compelled you to write it.
Well, as far as the book is concerned, there were a lot of great ideas in a lot of great books, and a lot of them were applicable. But they weren't all in one place, or a lot of them weren't in one place. And so Reinvent Your Enterprise tried to take the ideas of Peter Drucker and 200 other people and integrate them into a way that's practical and in a way that helps people accelerate their enterprise initiatives.
And so I get the idea that there's a lot of focus in this piece of work around organizational change. Is that right?
Yeah, a tremendous amount.
And, you know, there are some people, more than a few, that have an opinion or two about that. You're not the first guy to come along and say, hey, here's some ideas on how to change an organization. What are some things that you discovered as you prepared to release this book? Did anything surprise you about this whole discipline of managing change?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest surprise was that the way we've all been taught to do it doesn't work. people know that it doesn't, that they struggle with it, but in terms of why it doesn't work isn't always clear. And the reality is that we're all taught to change through quantitative methods, objective plans, measures, very static project management routines. But when you put those into big organizations that are very dynamic in nature and have a lot of personalities and a lot of more social implications, those projects really fail. And the first person to really look at that and say, you know, this the scientific management approach that we've all used for the last 100 years doesn't work so well anymore was Peter Drucker. And Peter, along with a whole bunch of other people more in the social science area, have really created, I think, a framework that works in practice and for people who are academic in nature, actually works in theory also.
Jack, tell us a little bit about your company, Brand Velocity.
Brand Velocity is a company that focuses on large enterprise projects. We apply the principles of Peter Drucker and the principles of Reinvent Your Enterprise into large projects. Typically, they're many, many millions of dollars. Typically, they fail 70% of the time. And
wow.
by taking the approaches in the book Reinvent Your Enterprise, Brand Velocity helps people accelerate their projects and make them perform much better.
Did I hear you correctly that you fail 70% of the time?
Yep. The statistic, particularly on large enterprise projects, is that they fail 70% of the time to deliver on the original objectives. And actually, 20% of the time, they're stopped outright after a failure. So the track record is just horrible.
But isn't failure a good thing in a way? Isn't that how you learn?
You learn, but you don't want to learn on a $100 million project.
that's good point.
That's high tuition right there. So what are some things that get in the way of a well-executed enterprise-level change?
You know, surprisingly, the biggest problem is not clarity around where you want to go and why. People jump into the hows, they jump into the whats, and they don't really get clear as an organization of what they want to achieve to begin with and why they want to achieve it. And as a result of not doing that, the scope becomes very unclear very quickly. And as the scope gets unclear, the organization gets unclear, and as the organization gets unclear, the projects fail.
You know, we've had an all-star cast of guests on this show, consultants from every walk of life and every realm of business, and a common theme is this lack of clarity of vision or lack of goal.
We hear that a lot.
Why is that the case? I don't understand that.
The biggest reason is that people don't start there and stay there. And when you look through the four ingredients that make for a successful enterprise change, they revolve around a clear vision, which then constrains a design. Because if you don't have a clear vision, your design can be way too broad. And so one thing is really constraining another. So envision constrains design, so you get a clear design in terms of what you need to do and when. That constrains your build, which is how do you best do those things. And then when you get clear on how you're going to best do those things, then that constrains who's actually responsible for what. And so if you don't do those four things and do them in that order, it becomes very, very difficult to get an enterprise project executed because it's not clear who's on first. You get too many cooks in the kitchen, and you clearly start to create a vision after the fact and a vision by consensus, and that's the kiss of death for most large enterprise projects.
Well, to put it in terms that Stone and I can understand, if you don't have a destination, a map is worthless.
Yeah, no doubt. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there.
Any road will take you. Yeah, usually when I hear the word constrain, any word like that, mandatory, constrain, I cringe a little bit, but I mean it's important apparently to have some constraints on a change project, I think I'm hearing here. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's critically important because of the resources that you're applying. So it's a little bit like if you're going to go on a vacation and you don't determine where you're going to go, then you don't know whether you're going by plane or you're going by train or automobile. And the reality is that just like going on a vacation, once you decide where you want to go and why, then everything else falls into place. But that's really a constraint, because when you say you're going to go to Hawaii, that means you're not going to Paris, and that's a totally different travel plan.
Well, you know, we're really big on speed around here. We have a tremendous affinity for producing better results in less time. I get the sense that there's a great deal of attention in your book and in your work toward accelerating change, but doing it right. Talk to us a little bit about what can be done, if anything, to accelerate change and do it well.
In general, we have been able to accomplish projects at half the time and half the cost of the traditional model. And
how's that for ROI?
And so getting to the results faster and reducing the cost sooner, there's no question that the impact on the ROI is tremendous. But it also it does another positive thing, and it produces a bigger appetite for change. When somebody has a project that's supposed to take a year and it ends up taking 2 years, typically they don't want to come back to the well very, very quickly. But if they do a project that is successful and is done in a timely way, then there's a lot more appetite for further changes. And at the end of the day, that's really at the heart of sustainable competitive advantage.
Can you give our audience an example of the type of enterprise that you guys do work for?
They're typically Fortune 500 companies, and usually the projects are $50 million and up. Not all, but generally they're very large enterprise projects. And then, in addition, to get the vision right, a lot of times we'll work on the strategy end as well.
So corporate change is something that you do. Give us an example of a rapid corporate change.
The first one that comes to my mind is really what started the thinking behind brand velocity before it got really well developed, and that was a change of a company in Canada that is called Coca-Cola Beverages, and the company was losing $1 million a week. A team came up. Mm-hmm. And in a relatively short period of time for an organization that was over $1 billion and one of the largest companies in Canada at the time, was in a very short period of time, went from 16 to 8 manufacturing facilities, got those all ISO 9002 certified, went from 68 to 6 administrative centers, 68 to 1 data centers, all done in a 2-year period of time. And usually... companies would normally just take a piece of that and take 2 years, but to do it all in an enterprise way so that you can get it all done at the same time, the left hand knows what the right hand's doing, doing it with a few key leaders who are engaged and there at the right time, all of those things are critically important. The share price of the company during that time frame went from $3 to $22. And so everybody won. The customer won, the employees won because they could be part of a successful organization, and the shareholders won as a result.
Well, and the organization and the people leading it now have this this new level of confidence that they can pull major, large-scale, transformational kinds of change off, right, because of that experience.
Yeah, and it's being able to do that better, faster, cheaper, but also more holistically, so that you don't have a manufacturing plan that's going in one direction, an administrative plan that's going in another direction, a sales plan that's going in another, that you're really focusing on the customer, backing up and what that means from an operational perspective, and then getting those things done in a rapid way through a spirit of action, imperfection, forgiveness, continuous improvement.
I like that forgiveness. We could all use a little bit more of that. Well, let's dive into this book a little bit. Talk to me about what the senior level executive, the mid-level manager, maybe even the internal change consultant, what that person might get out of this book and how they might apply it.
I think it's a great book to have a very holistic view of business. So much of what we do is segmented, so it's very easy to find great marketing books or great finance books or great manufacturing books or great sales books, but there's not a natural linkage in those books in terms of how one piece fits with the others. And so what this book does first and foremost is create a framework that can integrate a lot of great ideas from a lot of great people. So I think it's a great general book for almost any function because it explains some great things about their function, but also how that function works with all the others. And I think when you start looking at enterprise change and enterprise reinvention, it really takes that holistic view. And so whether you're a CEO or a project manager or a consultant who's working on organizational change, I do think it level sets people for, you know, how to think about business and how to reinvent it. And then it also goes through some tools that are available to do it in practice and to do it faster.
Well, over the weekend, as I was eating my boiled peanuts down in Pensacola, Florida, and doing a little bit of pre-show research, I came across this term, strategic profiling. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What's that all about?
Strategic profiling is an instrument, a tool, that is designed to get people to work together and to accelerate change. And it's sort of like a Myers-Briggs for enterprise projects. And it ties to the book so that it brings the book to life and actually allows somebody to apply it right away. But then also there's a group version of strategic profiling that allows people to take the survey as an individual, but then also look at the results as a group. It allows people to make visible, you know, what is ordinarily invisible, you know, that what we've sort of accepted as a natural law, this whole notion of forming, norming, storming, performing, which takes months to get through.
Right.
But a lot of the storming is that people don't have a shared point of view and that they think their world revolves around them. So to have a framework bigger than any one individual and any one function, which a generalist book like Reinvent Your Enterprise allows, it then links into strategic profiling so that all of that stuff can be done much faster. And in practice, the action planning workshop, which is part of the strategic profiling linkage to the book, major plans can be put in place in one day. And those plans can then be executed in a clear way. And that's just completely different from the normal way of doing things.
Well, and I do think, and I've had some limited exposure to this world of change management. My uncle works for he runs a change management consulting firm, and I've read quite a bit on it. But I get the sense that most people walk into these projects just under the impression that any change, particularly if it's going to involve any substantial shift in culture, it's going to be slow. That's not really the case, is it? If it's managed properly,
it doesn't have to be. And a vision and a strong executive will can make a huge difference. And for instance, when it's clear what your company is not going to be, then you know the things you don't need to do and the people you don't need to involve. If you're not clear up front in terms of what it is you want to be, and what you don't want to be, then you can get the right people in the room and the wrong people out of the room. And at the end of the day, that's a big part of where cultural problems occur, is that there are too many cooks in the kitchen, and a lot of the people who are supposed to be moving the culture forward are actually dragging it behind just because they're not on the same page or they're being involved when they shouldn't be.
What a great way to put it. If you're clear about what your company's not going to be, what a great perspective to put on that. I got one more question before we need to wrap up this interview in a few moments, but I have one more question. I'm interested in your perspective on communication. It seems like there's an awful lot that goes unsaid in the throes of a major change project, and without good, accurate, timely information, people, I think, sometimes have a tendency to fill in those blanks themselves. Give us the 1 or 2 minute Jack treatment on communication at a change project, if you will.
It's critically important, and at the end of the day, it's what drives everything. Because once you know where you're going and why, what you're going to do and when, how you're going to do it, and who's going to be responsible for which tasks, all that stuff has to be communicated and regulated. One of the biggest mistakes made in large projects is that people handle it separately. And so a consulting firm will come in and a change management group will be put in place and they'll be communicating, and it becomes sort of a rah-rah type thing of why this is important enough to change. Communication has to be clear, it has to be consistent, and it has to happen through the hierarchy. And if you aren't getting all three of those things from a communication standpoint, the difficulty that it provides from a change management standpoint, or the help that it gives a change management program, is just one of the biggest factors that's out there.
Does the communication tools made available by the social web and new media and blogging and all these networking tools, does that facilitate and help the communication process, or in this day and age with the kind of change that you're dealing with, does that actually hinder it? make it more complicated?
It certainly enables it because most enterprise projects cross over large geographic boundaries. So to be able to handle time zones and different organizations and where you're not able to be physically in the same place at the same time, the communication technologies are great enablers. But if you're not clear on where you're going and why, then they can destroy a project, because now it's so easy to create your own constituency against where you're going and why. But if there's a single version of the truth, it's coming from the right area, it's connected to the right people, then I think those technologies are absolutely indispensable for change initiatives.
I mean, it seems like social media could be a real magnifier, is the way I see it. It's sort of like I envision money. You know, someone who's not a very nice person, you give them a lot of money, and they're really not a very nice person, and you can really see it. Someone who's just a good soul, you give them a lot of money, and they're a really good soul, and you can see it in so many different ways. That sounds like it could be a real magnifier. Switch gears for a moment with us, if you will. Tell us a little bit about the experience of writing the book and getting the book to market. What did you enjoy the most about that, and what, if anything, did you find a little bit frustrating or challenging?
It took a long time, and so sticking with it is, I guess, is frustrating. There was 5 years of research that was done before the book was written, and so that took a long time. At the end of the day, I think it's great to write a book if you're really passionate about the subject. If you're not passionate about the subject, it is a great waste of time.
What a great way to put it. Of course, your work goes well beyond the book. You have educational offerings, you have workshops, you have direct consulting. Give us, if you would, just a little bit of background on your work in general, and tell us how we can get in touch with you, how our listeners can find your book and learn more about your work.
Well, Reinvent Your Enterprise is on Amazon.com. It's very easy to get in either hard, soft, or digital form, so it's very easy to get. The company itself, Brand Velocity, is on www.brandvelocity.com, and it gives a good overview of the kinds of things we do, and I think is a great starting point in terms of taking a look at not only what you can do on your own from an accelerated change perspective, but then also where maybe some help would be in order as well.
Marvelous. Well, listen, before we let you go, Jack, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really, more importantly, what they feel like they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Sure. That could take another hour. A mistake that comes to my mind is when I was in the early 1990s, I was involved in distribution and warehousing for a large company, and I got enamored with a different way to do warehousing. And I fell in love with this notion, and it required a technology that hadn't been tested yet in that environment. And I fell so much in love with the notion that didn't really deter me from going full bore with it, and was encouraged to do so. It didn't work. I think the real learning is that you should always think big. Nothing wrong with that. It's how you start small. And to start small but progress along a continuum, fail, learn, adjust, and do it in a way where you can then quickly ramp up based on the learning and the failures and the successes that you have, rather than just jump right into the pool 100%. I think keep the vision, segment the steps, and if you do them step by step and progress along a continuum, you'll end up at the vision with a lot fewer wounds.
That sounds like marvelous advice. Keep the vision and segment the steps. We could probably trademark that, Todd, and do it before we even got out of here, couldn't we?
I agree.
Get on your Twitter thing with our trademark people, and we ought to get that nailed down. Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show, Jack. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been terrific.
Well, can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Sure, I'd love to.
Terrific. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, I am delighted to introduce a gentleman by the name of Jeff Lindsay. He's the author of Conquering Innovation Fatigue, Overcoming the Barriers to Personal and Corporate Success. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you, man. I didn't realize how tall you were until I saw you this morning. You know, I see you on the internet, and I see you on all the YouTube videos describing your work, and I see just a ton of information out on the internet about you and your work and your book, but none of it can just conveys the sheer height that you display.
I'll be posting a height chart right after the show today.
Yeah, you and the audience can't see what I'm seeing. Stone in one side of the table and Jeff in the other. It's I think you need some phone books.
Well, he could be an absolute ringer for the high-velocity basketball team, couldn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
So talk to us a little bit about this book. And, you know, as our last guest mentioned, it's a little bit of an undertaking to write a book. It's a lot of work. It can be a headache. You know, were you in your right mind? What in the world caused you to put energy into writing a book like this?
That is a fair question. I'm not sure I was in my right mind in doing it, but I love writing. I've been doing it for a long time. I was in academia before. I was in corporate America at Kimberly-Clark, and all those opportunities I had involved lots of writing. I found myself drawn toward blogging early on and my web pages and just really enjoy it. So about 2006, I started writing. But what motivated me to write was the whole concept of the personal journey of the innovator, the challenges that they face. My experiences in academia, I was at the Institute of Paper Science and Technology, which is right here in Atlanta on the Georgia Tech campus. A remarkable place. I was involved with some amazing people. We were creating a lot of cool inventions related to the pulp and paper industry. And yet, we missed the boat a number of times. We ran into all sorts of barriers that made it very hard to take really some world-class concepts and get them commercialized. So many things can go wrong in that process. Coming to Kimberly-Clark, I was involved in the research community, working with all sorts of inventors. I got very interested in patents and became a patent agent, and they created this unusual position for me called Corporate Patent Strategist, which I just loved. It was a chance to work with groups all over Kimberly-Clark. It's a very large company. They produce more patents than MIT, which is not all that significant when you realize how hard it is for universities to do patents. But they do some amazing research, a lot of great people, and they have about 20 different, when I was there, about 20 different groups around the company pursuing patents. So I got to work with all of them in terms of strategy, helping to build connections with universities and outside partners and coming up with ways to deal with disruptive innovation and all the challenges that are out there. And I saw so many stories where great concepts ran into unexpected barriers, or where the corporation itself had challenges that were truly unexpected and difficult to deal with. And as we started thinking about all of this, I realized that there are stories here that need to be told. As I look at the innovation literature, so many times it's coaching to the CEO or the top executives. Here's how you be innovative. Here's how you get vision. And they need that. But there are stories that are untold about, even if you have the vision of the CEO, so many things can go wrong at that personal level, the personal journey of the innovator. And I felt that story needed to be told.
Well, that's the word that caught my eye in the title was fatigue. So say more about how does this fatigue come about? I'm interested to hear more about how it occurs and, more importantly, maybe what we can do to stop it from happening so much.
Right. And there's been a lot of concern also when we proposed the concept for the book from various sources that talking about fatigue is so negative. Well, we have the positive spin of conquering innovation fatigue, but there is a negative element that needs to be faced, a brutal reality that we have to understand is there. There are many factors, we call them innovation fatigue factors, that stand in the way between stand in the way to success for that innovator or would-be innovator. And as we examined them, we came up with three main classes of these fatigue factors. And each one have several different types within them. Some of the fatigue factors occur at the personal level. Sometimes it is mistakes and dysfunctionalities of the inventors themselves or the would-be innovators themselves that are the real barrier, their own pride or arrogance or being too bought into their own work and not able to understand its defective features or the things that need improvement. That can be an example of a personal fatigue factor. Or bad behavior from people around them. Somebody else steals their idea. It can happen very easily. Or not invented here syndrome, where another group, maybe even within their own corporation, puts barriers in front of them because, hey, that's not our idea. We don't want to celebrate it or recognize its value. Maybe we want to squash it. These personal bad behaviors that occur represent a whole class of fatigue factors. And if you don't understand them, it's very easy to take the wrong route and fail in your innovation. Once you get past that, there are a series of fatigue factors that occur at the organizational level. This can include bad vision, poor execution of vision at the corporate level. It can also include, they can include failure to collaborate. One of the fatigue factors we talk about is open innovation fatigue, where a company, because of its culture, has a very difficult time working with outside companies to innovate. Yet most of the great inventions, most of the great technologies that a corporation needs are going to be outside. And if you're not reaching outside, if you have all these cultural barriers that are in the way to collaboration, you're going to fail. In addition to these fatigue factors that come at the corporate or organizational level or at the personal level, even if you have all that down and you're really perfect in those areas, there's still a whole other category that can get in the way. We call that external fatigue. These external fatigue factors can be things that come from the environment, such as regulation, legislation that gets in the way, creates incredible barriers for some companies. It can be related to the patent system. We have a whole section on patent fatigue, intellectual property related issues. And then there are a series of fatigue factors that, again, hinder open innovation, such as the collaboration between universities and industry. If you don't understand them, you don't know what these factors are, you can have a lot of things go wrong. So we try to keep things positive. We look at all these fatigue factors, but then offer workarounds or solutions that can help people overcome them.
And so you had your own real-time experiment in collaboration. You co-authored this book with two other people. What was that experience like?
Well, that is really interesting. My co-authors, Cheryl Perkins, she's the founder of Innovation Edge, where I'm director of solution development. It's a small consulting company. She used to be the chief innovation officer and senior vice president at Kimberly-Clark, where I worked. And she was so into open innovation, so successful doing this, that she went and formed a startup company that's really focused on open innovation, getting people connected and working with strategy. And with my background in intellectual property, patents, and so forth, was a very nice fit for the type of things I wanted to do and couldn't resist the temptation. I've had a wonderful time there. And my other co-author is Mukund Karanjikar. He is not with Innovation Edge. He is...
He ain't from around here either.
No, he's from India originally. And we have a strong theme in the book on immigration. We use the metaphor of immigration to describe the journey of innovators. Because an immigrant comes to the United States, the systems are different, the culture is different, the language is different. Who do you know how to trust? How does the system work? It can be very frustrating. It's that way for many innovators. They come up with some great concept, but they don't understand the world of finance. They don't understand corporate America, the litigation issues, the patent issues, and all these fatigue factors that stand in the way. And the journey of people like, you know, the inventor of television, Philo Farnsworth, who many people have never heard of, surprisingly, his journey is very much like an immigrant coming to the shores of the United States and trying to find out how does a system work? How do you get through it? How do you find success? So having him on board was extremely helpful. He was with Chevron when we started collaborating together. He's very active in the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, where I'm also chair of a division on bioproducts, forest bioproducts division. And we were collaborating, talking about it, and saw things much the same way. We decided to start working together and create this book. He's now doing energy consulting in Salt Lake City.
I think innovation is one of those words that probably is overused. And a lot of people, I don't know, a lot of people really understand what innovation really is. And I'm guilty of that. I don't know if you know, Jeff, that Stone had some innovation work in his background. And I was doing some work for a client, and I came up with this really clever idea. And I went to Stone and said, hey, here's my idea. What do you think? Is it, this is innovative, isn't it? He says, oh, sure, if it works.
Yes.
That was
my book on innovation.
If it sells.
That smacked me right between the eyes because I had... I suspect, like a lot of people perhaps, that innovation was being creative and coming up with that idea and doing the creative work to make something, make that idea, bring that to market. I never realized that it's only innovative if it works and, as you said, if it sells.
Exactly. Innovation is all about delivering. Ideas are cheap. In fact, nobody wants ideas. I have people call us up at Innovation Edge saying, hey, I've got this idea. It's going to change the world. and all I want is $1 million for it. Can you help me get it? And it's kind of heartbreaking to have to explain to people, well, I'm glad you have an idea, but essentially your idea right now is worthless. It's worthless until that idea is fleshed out and changed in some way that actually changes society. One of the key themes of our book is that innovation is about transforming society. There has to be a social adoption of the concept. So that means it has to work, it has to sell, has to meet needs of people. There has to be some way of disseminating it and spreading and going viral in some sense. If it's not changing people's lives, it's not really an innovation.
And that's what I would have told you if the conversation had have unfolded further, Todd. I would have told you all that.
No, I read all that into what you said.
Talk to us more about this whole concept of open innovation, because I've heard that term a lot. It occurs to me that there's some tremendous advantages if you can pull that off. But how do you get people from competing enterprises, from different frames of reference, from different perspectives, different cultures, to collaborate in such a way that you can really call it open innovation? What makes that work? And help us think that through a little
bit. Sure. This is a great question. One of the real transforming principles in our current society is collaboration. We see that happening on so many fronts. In the IT area, we got mashups, we have all the social networking that's bringing people together, and tweet-ups occurring. I know you guys just did one recently, done it quite a few times, I understand. These things that bring people together across boundaries are rich opportunities for creation. So much of innovation today occurs between the boundaries of disciplines, and it's no longer a day in which you can have one single lone inventor recreating the world. That will happen occasionally, but much of what's changing the world is when people get together with different perspectives, crossing boundaries, and collaborating. In a given corporation, you may have some very bright people, but 99.999% of all the bright people in that area are going to be outside your corporation because you can't hire everybody. So how do you tap into all that power? This is a very important theme of what we do at Innovation Edge, focusing on open innovation. In fact, our CEO, Cheryl Perkins, is the chair of the global conference on open innovation called CODEV, held every January in Scottsdale, Arizona. We did a day-long workshop there back in January with some of the leading minds of a number of corporations. Just had a fabulous time working out some of the details of this concept of open innovation. Open innovation means that you have a way of reaching out to the universities, to startups, to other corporations, maybe even your own competitors, and working together to collaborate in a win-win way. It requires a set of principles. It requires a different culture than many people are used to, but it is extremely successful. P&G, for example, has a majority of their new products, new innovations coming out, being a result of their open innovation strategy that they call Connect and Development, or Connect and Develop. And it's extremely successful. They're doing it well. They're one of the masters, but there are a lot of others doing it. And it's the way to succeed globally now.
I'll ask you the same question I asked our last guest. Do the tools of the social web facilitate and make that collaboration easier, or is it complicated?
That's a great question. For me, it really helps. Part of what I do is helping to find outside technologies for some of our clients. We have a client right now getting ready to launch a series of new products on the shelves of major retail stores. My job is to find the right technologies to go into some of these products, and I'm just having a blast doing it. One of the first things I did with their permission was to put out a little post on to my LinkedIn group. I use LinkedIn a lot. I use Facebook, Twitter, a variety of tools. Put out a little post saying, hey, I'm looking for some new technologies in this area. That evening, I had somebody literally knocking on my door saying, hey, I've got this. This might be what you want. And it was very close to what we were looking for. It gave us some new concepts, a new connection, learned about a whole new company we didn't even know about with the cool technology. I've put posts out there on blogs, on Twitter, and so forth, and been connected to people that were then helpful to us in what we do. You can waste a lot of time with Twitter and some of these tools if you don't know what you're doing, even if you do. But it is one resource you can consider. I'm not saying everybody should do it. Absolutely not. But it's a resource.
Well, the perspective you just outlined is more of a crowdsourcing kind of a concept of inviting ideas and getting inputs from an external community. But what about the actual tools in terms of facilitating the actual collaboration? I mean, I'm talking like a tool like Google Wave.
Right.
Is that a good thing for an organization, or does that put too many chefs in the kitchen?
That's a great question. The Google Wave itself raises a host of issues that much of the hype has not lived up to the potential, and there are some issues around security and privacy and so forth. So I'm not personally a fan of Google Wave, but I may become one in the future. But using technology to advance open innovation makes a lot of sense. For example, for collaboration, we use GoToMeeting a lot and other tools that can bring things together, let us do live presentations and share our screens and get discussion going. That's a very helpful tool. Sometimes something as basic, though, as a teleconference can be used to achieve a lot. You still need face-to-face meetings, though. As virtual as the world is becoming, you have to get down face-to-face with people, see what they've got, walk through their labs, press the flesh, get to know them. Still important.
Let's talk nature versus nurture for a moment here. When it comes down to the individual, is this knack for innovation, is it born in you? And if it's not, what can an organization do to bring it out of you?
Now, that's a terrific question. It's one that I think deserves a lot of discussion. I don't know if I have all the answers, but I will say this. There are some people that do seem to have a knack for it, just like there are people who seem to have a knack for piano, tennis, and other skills. But whether you have a lot of that knack or not, it can be learned. Innovation is a series of steps. There's a series of processes you have to go through. And with discipline, a spark of creativity, but with the discipline and knowledge of process and steps and pulling things together, you can be much more successful in innovation. Now, inventing may require a spark of genius, some people say, but collaborative innovation and the steps it takes to go from the idea to the product on the shelves is much more a skill that can be learned and requires learning, even constant learning and training. For example, the intellectual property area is part of innovation. If you ignore that, if you miss it, if you don't pay attention to it, you can fail. And intellectual property is all about learning the skills, the discipline. So it's more than just a knack. There's a lot of skills and processes that need to be mastered.
But I have a much clearer understanding of that process now as a result of this conversation, and that and why collaboration is so key, because there is the idea generation that is necessary. But as you say, without the implementation of that, it's worthless.
Exactly.
And so you don't have to necessarily be an idea guy to be a successful innovator, if I'm understanding you correctly, in that you have to be able to work the system and work through the cultural barriers, work through the governmental bureaucracies
right. That
slow things. So the collaboration is almost necessary.
An interesting example is back to the story I mentioned of Philo Farnsworth. Now, he starts off with a flash of genius. The issue is television. And when he was a 14-year-old boy, this was the early 1900s, everybody was talking about television. They knew the concept. How do we transmit images electronically? So the idea was there, the dream was there, but no one could do it properly. He was out, and the issue was, how do you break up an image and recreate it remotely? He was in Rigby, Idaho, on a potato farm, plowing the field, going down one line, turning around, back the other line, back and forth, scanning the field, and he was thinking about the television issue as a 14-year-old. Flash. The plowing of the field, the line, scan one line at a time, break up the image into a series of pixels, transmit it as one big stream, and recreate it as the scanned lines on the other end. Within seconds, he had the key vision that led to television, would become a patent, would become a business, would get him $1 million later as he won the patent wars against RCA. But that flash of genius had a long ways to go until we had the commercial television. And although he's now being celebrated, and I enjoy the fact that he's being recognized and celebrated now. I mean, he went to BYU. I'm a BYU alumnus, so hey, that's great. We like to think of him as one of our great heroes out there. But the reality is, well, the plays and books that are being written now portraying him as a victim of innovation fatigue from theft, as the evil David Sarnoff of RCA stealing his idea and beating him to a pulp, and he dies penniless in poverty in 1974. Just a very sad story. But the reality was he made a lot of mistakes, a lot of the mistakes that many inventors make, and he failed to collaborate effectively. And the real key to the innovation, one can argue, and so argues a good friend of mine who runs, or a friend of mine who runs the David Sarnoff library now, the argument is that the real innovator here was David Sarnoff, the man who saw the potential of this idea and had the understanding of how to translate that into commercial reality. He had access to the financial resources, to the marketing, to the development teams, to the legal issues that were all needed to be resolved, and could execute it. There's only been a handful of brilliant entrepreneurs like David Sarnoff, so my friend argues, while there are thousands of people with great ideas that don't go anywhere.
That's a really interesting perspective. It reminds me of Gates didn't write the DOS stuff, didn't he? Like find some other kid that wrote the DOS stuff and give him $50,000 or something? Or
oh, I don't know that story, but I'm sure there's countless examples like that.
Things like that are repeated over and over in history. Let's go back to the organizational level for a moment. I'm trying to envision trying to tap into the wealth of creativity and innovative potential in an organization. We get a group of really bright, talented, passionate people together, and we're trying to come up with a better mousetrap. And we generate 30, 35 ideas, I don't know, 100 ideas. Well, we're only probably going to take a few of those through our innovation pipeline to try to come up with something commercially viable. How do you shelve those other 98 ideas without turning those people off and creating a culture that they're going to be just as excited next month when they come back together to build another mousetrap?
That's another great question, and it's actually a whole chapter in our book is dedicated to this. That process, often called the innovation funnel, is what many corporations do. They will create this idea. We have to put in tons of ideas into the funnel, and only a few are going to drip out at the end and be successful. And the innovation community, whether that's new product developers or R&D people or folks at a university in collaboration, they are told pretty much, don't get your hopes up. We're going to take out of every 1,000 ideas, only one's going to go anywhere. So just do your best work, throw it in, and don't hope for anything. That gets very old.
After you've been rejected
10, 20 times, why bother? And one of the real challenges of innovation in a corporation is keeping your people incentivized to do their best work. And it's a big focus of our book, what it takes to keep that will to share from in your innovation community fresh and alive and vibrant. Well, the innovation funnel has a huge drawback. One of the problems is in that funnel process, there's often a series of handoffs. So people dump the ideas into a portal or turn in invention disclosures or whatever. Some other committee takes it from there. Another committee takes it from there. And finally, it might get down to a team that goes through another series of handoffs. Well, and that can often happen when you're doing a stage and gate process where you have handoffs from one team to another. In that process, the innovators, the idea people are out of the loop. And things get handed off one generation to another, and what gets out into the market may have no connection to the vision that they had. That's also very discouraging. We advocate very strongly the need for a feedback loop, keeping the inventors, the innovators, the idea people in this loop so they're constantly getting feedback. They're aware of what the market is saying. They're aware of what focus groups are saying. When a prototype is taken to customers and they say, oh, this is awful, I wish it had this or that feature, they know it, and they're able to quickly iterate and adjust. We use the theme or the metaphor of a French horn in a chapter called The Horn of Innovation. And I don't know if you're familiar with the French horn. One of my sons is a tremendous hornist, and I've learned a lot from him. In the French horn, the key to how the music comes out involves a technique called hand stopping. You actually stick your hand in the end of the horn as you're playing, and you can adjust the tone or the pitch. You can go up and down a note by how you cup your hand. And to play effectively, you have the buzz that goes into the horn. That initial buzz is very raw, very unpleasant sound that you're blowing into the horn. As it goes through the pipes and chambers of the horn, the sound is mellowed and refined. And then what comes out at the bell at the end, you're still shaping. You have a hands-on approach at the very end while you're shaping the sound. To me, that's a metaphor for how innovation should be done. You have the inventors. They're putting other ideas into the funnel, so to speak. But think of the funnel now as reversing. The French horn is like a reverse funnel. It's narrow at the end, and it gets broad as it comes out. They are putting the energy in, the raw, crude buzz, but they're shaping the tone. The corporate systems, the stages and gates and so forth help refine and mellow that inventive energy. And the inventors still have a hands-on approach all the way to the end where they can help shape the final output. They're in this feedback loop. The sound comes out, they hear it, they're there seeing the director, the score, this whole feedback loop that involves ears, eyes, lips, all integrated. The biggest barrier to keeping innovators incentivized in a corporation is the fact that they feel left out of the process. If you keep them included and let them be there to help shape the final output beyond the teams that are working with the consumers, with the marketplace, then they can quickly shape and react to that feedback and better direct their energies. And this results in what we call targeted innovation. So instead of taking 1,000 ideas and finding the one that passes through all these barriers, target. Help your innovators understand what the score is, what the needs are, what the market's telling, what market research is guiding you, and take these things iteratively and let them have this hands-on approach. In that case, what they're blowing into the horn isn't all wasted breath. Something's coming out, and they're helping to shape it. So that's a quick overview of a much longer issue, and it doesn't work for all industries. It may not be right for biopharmaceuticals, for example, but for many, especially consumer products, using this horn of innovation concept can give you much more targeted innovation with inventors as part of a feedback loop that makes their efforts not so much wasted breath, but a refined process that keeps them involved, included, and motivated.
Well, you're absolutely right. That was a great question on my part.
Yeah, the answer was pretty good, too.
Yeah, it was very good. The horn of innovation. We got to cut that out separately. And
you know, I was thinking the exact
that's
same.
Marketable, too, right? We could sell this.
Absolutely.
You know, Todd and I are always thinking commercial viability.
I've already put the trademark symbol after it. Sorry about that.
What happened to the whole open innovation concept you were preaching earlier?
I'll collaborate with you guys. Sounds great. Let's do it.
Well, I do have one more question. For those poor schleps out there that don't have their own radio show, and by virtue of that, don't get a free copy of your book, how can they find your book, learn more about your work, and get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Sure. As Jack said about his book, mine is also on Amazon. You can. We have a blog that supports the book, innovationfatigue.com. That's all one word, innovationfatigue.com. And you can click on the book link there and order directly from Amazon. A number of bookstores also carry it.
Well, listen, before we let you go, you saw us do this with our earlier guest, and we'd certainly like you to do this for us as well, if you would. We'd like to ask each guest to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career and what they feel like they learned from it. Could we con you into doing that as well?
Sure, that'd be great. One of my disadvantages in life is having a chemical engineering degree, and I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but a PhD, chemical engineering from BYU. But the chemical engineering training kind of helps people see things very black and white. It tries to be very logical. You get the equations. There's a right answer to questions. And if you have the right technology, boy, it should be adopted over the inferior technology. That's not how the world works. And I think one of my big mistakes in my early years at Kimberly-Clark was taking the kind of engineering approach to how things work and not realizing that the way innovation really occurs and the way things really happen in any corporation, it's all about personal relationships. It's about the network. It's about people knowing you, liking you, buying into what you have. And just because you present an idea or a concept or a proposed change that is very logical and meets all the criteria and might be superior to alternatives doesn't mean that's going to go anywhere. You have to have that network, and you have to also be very sensitive to the feelings of other people, how they might misinterpret your intentions or your desires. And sometimes I've learned eventually, sometimes it's important to just step back and take a loss or take a hit and choose very carefully which battles you really fight when battles need to be fought. And when you do have to fight a battle, work on the relationships. Make sure you network effectively across your corporation and beyond so that you have people who understand where you're coming from and can support you. Don't just expect things to happen because you think it's logical and very clear. So I could get into some real specific stories around that theme, but the general idea, being more sensitive to feelings, politics, and working better on networking early on, not just thinking like an engineer, is an important lesson.
Well, I think that was extremely well said. Step back, get some perspective, be willing to get some help, and relationship is key, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's all about relationships.
In every walk of life, in every element of business.
Well, and we're so blessed, Todd. We get to build such great relationships by having the radio show. What a fun, marvelous, informative show this
morning.
Gosh,
my brain's overheating. A lot of smarts in the room today.
Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, Jack Bergstrom, Jeff Lindsay, our producer Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.